as you may be able to tell from the opening music this week, we have had a format change on this podcast as we say hi and we welcome you in, everyone. Hi, I'm Tyler Mon.
And I'm Anthony Masterson.
And we've decided to change things up. This is no longer a Rockies podcast in the sense, in the baseball sense of the word. This is now a Rockies podcast in the sense that we will talk about the Rocky movie franchise from here on out, because that seems more exciting than the offseason has been so far.
Yeah, that's smart. That's real smart on our part.
So we'll talk about the Rockies. It'll just be the Rockies, as in Rocky 1 through 39 and Creed and Rocky Balboa and all of those.
I mean, if you don't mention Ivan Drago right away, I mean, Ivan Drago is by far my favorite Rocky villain. Come on.
They could probably sign the guy who played Drago to be the first baseman at this stage, and I think it'd work out.
Steroids and all, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. I think it'd be fine. I think that'll work.
And it's a sweet precursor to the war we're about to have. So, you know.
Yeah exactly. No,
the Cold War is back. It's great.
And, it's only back, though, if our government is adversarial to the other one rather than just, like, slobbering it up.
Yeah, well.
Oh, man, this guy's so smart. He's so smart. Look at him playing the media. Like, no, you're not supposed to like
that.
You're not supposed to like that one. No, not really. Not really. But, yeah, that'll be great. So we'll cover the Balboa-Drago fight in depth. We'll talk a lot about U.S.-Soviet Union relations as they related to the making of the movies. It's a whole new Rockies podcast, folks.
We're going to karaoke No Easy Way Out?
Yeah. It's going to be fun. We're going to have some fun with this. Right? Are we?
No.
Is there fun allowed to be had in the world anymore? Because it doesn't really feel like it.
Nah, not usually.
Nah. Nothing's good. No. Hey, hi. Hi, everyone. Hi. Welcome in, Purple Dinosaur Podcast.
We're just joshing you. Just yanking your chains.
Just yanking your chains. No, we're still going to talk about this baseball team that we follow for some reason. We'll do that this week. But no, we're back. It is our first podcast of 2017. 20 Todd Helton.
My God.
It's going to be great. And our first show since November 30th. So we skipped the entire month of December, which is kind of fitting because the Rockies basically did too. I'm actually kind of proud of that joke. I was actually okay. Since we last did a show, I guess things have kind of happened. Have they? I don't know.
There have been a couple of signings that sent some waves throughout the Rockies world.
They
the Ian Desmond signing.
Waves. Yeah, we haven't even talked about the Ian Desmond signing because we texted the day that it happened. Rockies decided to sign Ian Desmond on December 7th. We texted the day that it happened and thought our consensus was, well, this isn't going to be the only move. Why don't we wait for all the dominoes to fall? And then we'll talk after that. And, by God damn, it may be the only move.
You know, we do that a lot. We did that with the Jose Reyes and Tulo trade as well.
We
I think
totally
we mentioned
did.
that Jose Reyes would be akin to Mike Piazza Marlin, as Jose Reyes Colorado Rocky would
yep.
be. And it's still in the footnote of history.
Yeah.
It'll probably be just as memorable. But, yeah, we did not see that one coming at all.
Nope. We sure didn't. I think we were kind of in the same boat as it related to Ian Desmond and – and right now, certainly doesn't look like there is more on the horizon. Let's break it down. So the Colorado Rockies sign Ian Desmond, former Washington National, former Texas Ranger, former shortstop, maybe now a former outfielder. As it looks, the Rockies are set to make Ian Desmond their primary first baseman for 2017, a position that he has never played, not just professionally, a position he has never played in a competitive baseball game.
Maybe since, like, you know, even that Brown is younger, you know, if you're, you're a good defender when you're younger, you're playing shortstop.
Right.
So.
And he even said in his press conference, I don't remember ever playing first base, like high school, little league, nothing.
It's not that hard. Tell him, Wash.
It's incredibly hard. That happened. I'm going to let you give your thoughts first. Ian Desmond, last season, waited around a little while to sign. signed for, you know, a bit of a down contract. It was his age 30 season with the Texas Rangers. Batted 285, 335, 446. Got acclimated to a new position. Primarily a shortstop in his Washington Nationals career. He, of course, spent 2009 to 2015 with the Nationals. He did also see a little bit of time in the outfield, if you can count two games between 2009 and 2010 as being in the outfield a little bit of the time. You know, but then he was fine as an outfielder for the Texas Rangers. He was a serviceable outfielder. He got acclimated pretty well. But the Rockies are signing.
He made the
All
Star team last year.
Yeah, like he was an effective player. But the Rockies are signing a guy who has never played first base to be an everyday first baseman. Your thoughts?
Well, what I worry about in the long run is that he does not know how to play first base, and it's not an easy position to learn. It's easier than, say, going from first base to shortstop, and that's fine. But the reason that the Rockies seemed to want to sign Ian Desmond was not just because he was going to be the everyday first baseman, was because it gave them versatility and another solid right-handed bat in that lineup. Now, there are some things that give me pause, of course. The 285 average was his highest in 4 years, playing in a very high-octane offensive environment as well in Texas, which is, you know, what he was not doing in Washington. But fact is, he got moved to the outfield because he was becoming such a poor defender, and his errors were piling up at shortstop throughout the years. He had 27 2 years ago with the Nationals, which I think was one of the tops in the league that year. But, you know, there are good things about Ian Desmond. There are bad things. The thing I worry about last year is that, yes, he was an All-Star, but his second half was not as great as his first. In the first half, when he made the All-Star team, he hit .322. He had an OPS of .899 with 15 homers. In the second half, he hit just .237 with a .630 OPS and only 7 home runs. So, you know, if they're giving him all that money because of a good first half he had last year that made the All-Star team, that's a little dicey. What I do like, though, is he gives them another added element on the base paths as well. Last year, another 2020 season. That was his fourth of his career. That is tied for the third most among all active players. Only Hanley Ramirez and Carlos Beltran have more 2020 seasons than Ian Desmond. So those are all things that I don't think all came with it. We thought they would be going out to get somebody else. And, you know, they could still be trying to shop players. I mean, there's still rumors going around that John Morosi is putting out there about Charlie Blackmon going to Toronto or St. Louis or Chicago, and not just Morosi, other people as well. So there are rumors still out there that could necessitate something else happening with the Rockies. And if, you know, if Blackmon does get traded, Ian Desmond could see himself back in center field again. Who knows? But as of right now, you're looking at Ian Desmond first baseman. And, you know, I'm not sure the bat can play, even though, you know, he's done very well in Coors Field in his abbreviated career against the Rockies, but that's because he's facing, you know, Rockies pitching. So I don't know. It's something that I want to like, and I cannot imagine me being totally thrilled when it happens on opening day.
Yeah. Yeah, pretty well says it. there's been so much of this conversation that just kind of seems like we're all in the bargaining phase where for a long stretch of time since this signing, there has been a sizable portion of Rockies Twitter and even baseball Twitter at large. I mean, Nick Stellini had a good piece that he wrote, our good buddy who's on Twitter at Stellini Tweets. We had him on the show a few weeks ago, in which he said, you know, I kind of just can't see how the Rockies are serious about this. GMs, front office people, they're not always the most forthright. They're not always the most honest. They shouldn't be.
Exactly.
You don't want a guy coming out and saying, no, this is what we're doing, and playing, showing all of his cards, because that's not the way competitive front offices, competitive people in front offices work, and it's not the way successful teams are built. I get that. But Nick also kind of ended his piece by saying, they're also the Rockies. Maybe they are just planning on playing Ian Desmond at first base, that seems to be the national reaction. It's like, if this is really what the Rockies are doing, then this is the most Rockies thing we've seen in a long time. But it also fits right into the bill of, well, God knows what the Rockies are going to do.
Well, it was that whole Gerardo Parra thing. Like, oh, well, he's hit so well in Coors Field. Yeah, Ian Desmond at 379 in 23 career games in Coors Field against Rockies pitching. That's not the same thing as playing their 81 games out of the year. Though, of course, you know, you have to imagine that he's going to hit very well because most guys who come into Denver seem to hit very well. I'm not really sure why. Maybe it's because of Coors, but who knows?
Right.
But, you know, he's back to playing the infield, and he was not a very good infielder a couple years ago. I mean, his errors went up almost every single year for about four straight years. His batting average went down in that same time. His OPS went down in that same time. He really screwed himself by turning down what was, I think, believe, a $100 million extension given to him or offered to him by the Nationals. Turned it down a year before free agency, thinking he can get, you know, bet on himself and do better. And unlike Max Scherzer, he did not. So he had to sign a very abbreviated deal last year with the Rangers, got his, you know, value back up. And, you know, kudos to him. He played well enough and found some team to give him $70 million. So,
yeah.
You know,
that was the other thing.
If he can try to replicate that, you know, 285, 335, 446 slash line that he had,
yeah,
you know, I mean,
those numbers are great. They'll be bumped quite well at Coors Field.
You think they'll be bumped, you know, but at the same time, like, he's a 782 OPS isn't right. Great for a first baseman.
Exactly. That's the thing. If you're getting that production from a guy who's playing, you know, in a non-premium power position, I think you're very satisfied with that. But if you're bringing a guy in and you're asking him to slot into a lineup between Carlos Gonzalez and Nolan Arenado, and that's what he's bringing to you, I'm not – like I was saying, I think for a long time, and still we're kind of in this mode where people are thinking, there's no way this is it, right? Like, there's no way they're actually doing this, right? He's not – this isn't actually the solution at first base. And there are still options out there. There is still time for this to look very different. But Edwin Encarnacion has been signed, which, let's be fair, I'm not sure was the best fit in the first place because Edwin Encarnacion, you know, has never been a primary first baseman. He hasn't played a full season wire-to-wire like he would in the National League at first base.
Right.
So maybe he's not the solution anyway. He's an older player, et cetera, et cetera. You know, you can make an argument that Mark Trumbo defensively, you know, he's a guy that was leaned on heavily as a designated hitter, not as a first baseman. But, you know, Chris Carter is still out there. There are definitely pieces that could be added that make a whole hell of a lot more sense at first base. And the money, they tied a lot of money. Not an outlandish amount of money, but when you're the Rockies, you basically can hand out two of those deals of what they gave Ian Desmond. And to give Ian Desmond one who, you know, plays his natural position is a position that you're set in Trevor Story. And the position where he moved last year is a position where you're already arguably way overcrowded in the outfield. So throwing that money to a guy who's never played first base when you could have thrown that money at people who have played first base and likely signed them, I don't know. Right now it's leaving a lot of us very puzzled. And yes, we're recording on January 3rd. Pitchers and catchers don't report for 6 weeks. Position players don't report for another 2 months, really. But at this stage, we're teetering on the brink, I think, of a lot of people jumping off of the Breidich bandwagon if it doesn't work.
Well, I mean, yeah, we're getting to a point where there's enough of a sample size for Jeff Breidich. It's not just 1 year where he's dealing with bad contracts from the previous regime and trying to get out of it. You know, these are things that players are there because of the decisions Jeff Breidich has made at this point. So it's about to be his fault or his doing what the Rockies do well. So he's going to have to take responsibility when pretty much what happens this year, it's going to be the first year where it's really going to be on the shoulders of Jeff Breidich 100%.
Oh, boy. This one is, for a while, both you and I consistently were like, this can't be it. I mean, this isn't it. This can't be it. They're going to make something happen. Something's going to happen. They've been talking so long about it. They've got all this money to spend over the offseason. They've got freedom, stuff built in the payroll. They really feel confident they can go out, put some money in places where they need it, bring back talent to fill. They've already got a core they're excited about. Only a couple of spots that need to be filled. And then Ian Desmond at first base is the solution. Okay, now on the flip side of this, the one thing that I will say I like about this from the Rockies' perspective, I like the fact that it shows a little bit of outside-the-box thinking. I think that's healthy.
Sure.
And I do like what Jeff Breidich said, that we like athletes who are versatile. We like guys who can play multiple positions. We like guys that we can put in the lineup at various spots. Look at what Daniel Descalso did last year. They had Descalso at first base, and he handled it okay. Except for that one play where he and DJ were covering the bag simultaneously.
I don't know.
Was that last year?
That was gold. That was last year.
It was very early on last year. But, you know, so I don't fault the Rockies for that philosophy. I think that can be a healthy and productive thing. Wanting guys who can play multiple positions, wanting guys who are athletic, wanting guys who are versatile. And I also think that there is a lot still to be said for the idea that maybe they're not done. There's a really good piece up on Purple Row by Eric Garcia McKinley. The headline is very simple. Ian Desmond doesn't make sense for first base. And there's some really good comparisons in there between Desmond, Mark Trumbo, Chris Carter, Jose Abreu. The dream scenario, and we talked about this, I think would have been and would still be Jose Abreu. But with the way Rick Hahn and the Chicago White Sox won the winter meetings, the Rockies would have to give up a ton of assets to bring in Jose Abreu. And I think there is still a strong chance that it could be worth it. But the Rockies right now are like a second-tier minor league system. I mean, if you're considering, you know, the Yankees and the Braves and some of those just loaded minor league systems at the upper echelon, I think the Rockies slot right in there at the back end of the top 10 in most talented systems in baseball right
now.
I think
so, yeah.
So if you swing a deal, you know, like what the Washington Nationals gave up to get Adam Eaton or like what the Boston Red Sox gave up to get Chris Sale, I think the Rockies would automatically be toward the bottom two-thirds, the bottom third, I should say, in terms of the talent in their minor league system, because that would require a lot of talent going the other way in order to bring somebody like Jose Abreu across. But Chris Carter's still out there. Mark Trumbo is still out there. There are options still theoretically available, and maybe we look back on this and it's all moot. But at this stage, I'm scratching my head a lot.
Yeah. And you worry that Ian Desmond just got tired at the end of last year, too. I mean, he had the most at-bats he's ever had in his career. You know, you wonder if that was a huge part of it. And maybe, you know, once he realized that he was going to be healthy and be this guy again, that he could be a little bit better because he had a terrible August, bounced back a little bit in September. But you have to see how he performs in spring training. If it's going to be an easy transition for him to come into first base and know he's going to be playing at first base all winter, basically, ever since he got signed, knowing that was going to be his lot. If he comes in and he's ready to go and he's put in a lot of work, taking, you know, 500 ground balls a day, who knows? Then if he puts in the work and he's going to be that, you know, that kind of guy, and that's a great sign. But there's a lot of unknowns right now that nobody is aware of. How's it going to work?
So that's been the big headline over the last few weeks. And, you know, don't freak out yet. It's January 3rd. It's January 4th. It's January whatever by the time you listen to this. Don't freak out just yet. But at the same time, maybe withhold a little bit of hope for 2017 because things seem as much confusing as anything else as of right now. But, you know, that's where we are. It's where we are as Rockies fans perpetually. I guess it's better to be confused about this than be confused about giving Boone Logan $30 million when you're nowhere near contending.
Well, speaking of similar contracts given towards Boone Logan, let's talk about Mike Dunn,
right,
the other guy that the Rockies ended up signing in their big free agent haul of two players. Mike Dunn, formerly of the Miami Marlins, spent the last 5 years in South Florida. Last year, 42 and a third innings, 51 games, appeared out of the bullpen. He was a 3.40 ERA, 38 punchouts, and 42 and a third, and he is signed to be the new lefty in the bullpen for the Rockies. And my favorite thing on Twitter, I think, whenever we had to do with the Rockies, of course, and national people talking about the Rockies, is that everybody's always clamoring on Twitter that the Rockies need to sign relievers and need to probably overpay for relievers and need to sign pitchers. And then when the Rockies go out and do these things, the reaction is almost immediately, oh, what a dumb deal. What are the Rockies doing? Oh, the Rockies are so cute, trying to sign every reliever coming out on the market. It's a no-win situation, clearly, amongst the court of public opinion on Twitter, because every time the Rockies do something that everyone consensusly believes they need to do, it gets ripped apart immediately without even a thought. But that's just Twitter. So it's a cesspool.
Oh, yeah. No, it's the worst. It's the absolute worst. But that is That is very true. I mean, it's the Rockies could go out and sign the ghost of Dennis Eckersley's baseball career, because I know he's not dead, and people would still rip on it as it being the worst move ever made just because they're the Rockies. And, you know, I guess some of that is somewhat justified because the Rockies haven't been a winner consistently, and you have to win consistently to get people to respect the decisions that you make. But you also can't clamor for something to be done and then when it's done, just immediately trash it for really no reason. I mean, Mike Dunn is an effective arm. What is Mike? You're not signing Mike Dunn and asking him to play left field. It's not a bizarre.
Maybe he can play first base. I don't know.
Exactly. It's not one of those strange sort of transactions where you scratch your head and go, what the hell are they doing? Like, they go out, they throw decent money at a good relief pitcher, and everybody's like, this is ridiculous. Why would they do this? That's all anybody's wanted him to do. By the way, Mike Dunn will henceforth be known as Nude Mink, the way Boone Logan was Bone Lagoon. I'm going with Nude Mink for Mike Dunn.
You're weird.
Is that okay?
No, it's not okay.
I'm tweeting it out right now.
Oh my God. No, then there are things that I understand why people were skeptical about the right. Mike Dunn signing in a bubble.
Sure.
Because Mike Dunn only had a 28% ground ball rate, which you have to imagine is not the greatest thing in the world if you're going to be a pitcher at Coors Field for most of your time next year. The strikeout rate, again, not great. The home runs per nine was good last year, but think about where he was playing. He was playing in Marlins Park, one of the most cavernous places you can actually pitch in the big leagues. So that number is bound to regress a little bit. So I understand why people were not liking the decision, but there were not a lot of really solid lefty relievers on the market this year. And the Rockies ended up with probably the top pitcher in the second tier of lefty relievers on the free agent market this year after Aroldis Chapman and, you know, whatever. So it's a move they kind of had to make. And if you're going to sign as a pitcher with the Rockies, you're more than likely going to have to overpay. So it wasn't like they gave him $20 million a year. It was like, what, 3 for 19? It's not your money. The Rockies needed to do something with it. They needed to get a reliever, needed to fill some holes in the back of that bullpen. And they think they're not going to be signing him to try to close games. That's not going to be Mike Dunn's role.
Right.
He's going to be more of a loogie.
Right.
You know, come in, get a couple guys out, and hand it over to some hard throwers in the back end. So, you know, you got your Adam Ottavinos, your Carlos Estevez's, your
Jairo Diaz, hopefully.
Yeah, Jairo Diaz, hopefully. Hopefully Jake McGee figures out what the hell went wrong last year. You know, it gives them solid depth and a guy who's had a lot of success in the big leagues, and I don't see why that's an issue.
And that's another thing that I think we need to point out that you noted there. Mike Dunn got $19 million over 3 years. Ian Desmond got $70 million over 5 years. Those are both pretty well below market value for what you're bringing in each of those guys. I mean, for Ian Desmond, for his production, guys right now are getting $20 million a year for that type of production. So you're bringing him in relatively under the wire for what you can expect given his theoretical return. And for Mike Dunn, $19 million over 3 years, this is baseball, folks. This isn't the NFL. That's a cheap deal in baseball, $19 million over 3 years, which is unconscionable to those of us who work normal person jobs, but that's not breaking the bank, and neither is Ian Desmond. Now, that being said, as we noted, when you're the Rockies, you really only have the budget, you really only have the wiggle room for maybe two of those big deals, if that. So if the Rockies are going to go out and throw some more money at somebody else, they've really got to hit on it, and they've really got to make sure that it fits into the plan given the constraints of the roster. Because right now, if the Rockies go out and sign a first baseman, somebody's got to get traded because you're paying Ian Desmond $70 million. He's not going to sit on the bench for $70 million. I mean, somebody, especially more than likely in the outfield, is going to have to be traded. And right now, you know, Charlie Blackman's the most obvious candidate, but that doesn't necessarily mean – this isn't MVP baseball. This isn't the show. You don't just put a guy up to trade him and all of a sudden he's traded. There has to be a fit for another team also.
Right.
So there are a lot of things that seem to suggest – that maybe this is actually as far as this offseason is going to go.
Yeah, and
I don't know.
I don't know. I can't imagine that being the case, but at the same time, it's totally probably going to happen.
It's the Rockies, man. still the Colorado Rockies.
And I fully believe that Jeff Bradich believes that his team is ready to go in next year and compete with the team that they have. They saw the good steps they made last year. They think they have a lot of pitchers like John Gray and Jeff Hoffman, Tyler Anderson, ready to step in to those roles and become stars in their own right. I think he knows his lineup is going to be very, very loaded, as always. He has, you know, bashers at pretty much every position now. And, you know, I think the last part was to get the bullpen kind of settled down, because that was obviously a terrible aspect of the Rockies games last year, like most years, it seems like. So he went out and got one of the better guys on the market to do so. That's all what it comes down to.
The Rockies also made a deal with the utility man Alexi Amarista, a one-year major league contract. The club, as of last week, had not confirmed this deal, but I think it's pretty well set in stone. Amarista was non-tendered by the Padres after batting .257, .295, .271 in 65 games last season. He has played with the Angels and the Padres in his career. So far, his career number is .230, .276, .320. You know, they're not spending a ton of money on Alexi Amarista. Whatever. If he fills the utility role. Yeah. If he fills the Christian Adames role a little bit more effectively than Adames did, then that's fine. So that is, as of right now, where we sit with your Colorado Rockies going into the 2017 season. Now, here's what we're going to do. This is PDP 91, by the way. I just skipped over the – no, this is 92 now.
It's 92, I
Holy
believe.
Holy smokes.
Yeah.
Wow. So it's not yet a big league year. We don't have a number. We don't have a player number for this one, but we are now, 1 year, one episode away from being in the inaugural season year of the Rockies franchise. So 92, the last year of minor league baseball in the city of Denver. So there's something you can put in your hat. But we are going to take your Ask PDP questions. We got a lot of them, but before we do that, we are going to have a conversation with a guy that we have come to know and really enjoy on Twitter over the last couple of years. Former MLB editor for Sporting News, a Baseball Writers Association of America member, as well as a Sabre member, and the creator now of the Baseball by the Book podcast. Justin McGuire joins the show to talk a little bit of Rockies and a lot about his new podcast and what he's up to for the 2017 season. Justin McGuire joins the show next. Pump for our next guest on episode number 92 of the Purple Dinosaur podcast, a former MLB editor with Sporting News. Justin McGuire joins the show, who for some reason has subjected himself to following us on Twitter for quite some time. we've done the same, but he's like intelligent and smart and fun to read and fun to listen to. And what's going on, man? Welcome.
Hey, how's it going? Good to be on with you guys.
Absolutely. It's great to have you. So we're going to talk a little bit of about the Rockies, but we're mostly going to talk about Justin's new podcast, which is something that you should all subscribe to and tune into. It is the Baseball by the Book podcast, which is now on episode number 7, which I believe just came out. Was that today?
Yeah, that was today, Tuesday okay. the 3rd.
So that is a conversation with Doug Wilson, who is the author of Brooks, the biography of Brooks Robinson. So you can go find that on iTunes. We'll talk about the podcast in a little bit. But before we do that, because we are ostensibly a Colorado Rockies podcast, although we talked at the beginning of the show about how at this stage we'd probably be better served just to have like a Rockies podcast where we talk about the Rocky movies rather than the Rockies, the baseball team.
Hey, I'm a big fan of the first Rocky. I can talk about that for hours.
Okay, we'll bring you back on when we break down the very first Rocky. Well, I just want to go from kind of like a flying at 30,000 feet evaluation of the Rockies from a national perspective, because one of the topics that we discussed in the opening segment today was the Ian Desmond signing. If the Rockies are being run by a competent front office and they end up still swinging a deal for Chris Carter or Mark Trumbo or whatever, then maybe Ian Desmond slots into the outfield somewhere. And maybe opening day comes in 2017 and you think, man, this is a really loaded lineup. This is a team that looks really good. And also, haha, remember when we all thought Ian Desmond was going to be the opening day first baseman? If it doesn't go that way, I feel like right now this very much fits into the narrative of, well, they're the Rockies. Who the hell knows what they're doing? What, you know, just from your perspective, from all your time working at baseball, working at Sporting News, what do you think the national perspective is on this organization?
Well, yeah, I think it's what you just said. I think there's a feeling that it's not an organization that has a grand plan, that really has really knows what it's doing long term. I hate to say that because I'm talking to Rockies fans here, but yeah, it's certainly the perception that you know, there's a lot of good young talent on that team. I think there's certainly that perception, but it seems to be kind of directionless. And I think that, like you said, if Ian Desmond ends up as your first baseman, that seems just like a waste, honestly.
There is, I think, kind of one parallel that I feel like I always try to tell Rockies fans, no, look at what happened here. That seems to be the plan that they're trying to follow, and that's the Pirates. And the Pirates, yeah. I mean, were a laughing stock for 25 years, and then all of a sudden they're one of the best teams in baseball, still competitive in the most competitive division in baseball over the last couple of years. Does anybody else come to mind when you think of an organization that at one time you were thinking, like, I don't know what the hell this team is doing, and then all of a sudden they got it figured out?
Well, I'm an Orioles fan.
And they're, you've been there.
I still don't know if they know what they're doing, but they have had, they've at least had some on-field success the last five seasons or so, four or five seasons. But again, I can't tell you whether that was part of a grand plan or that's just been pure dumb luck. I think it's a little bit of both. So yeah, the Pirates is a good example. Obviously the Royals is a good example. They're a team that was in the wilderness for longer than the Pirates, really, in you know, the grand scheme of things. And they figured it out, obviously. The Astros were a team that hit rock bottom for a few years there and are now competitive. So I think you look at any of those. The thing with the Rockies is I don't think they've hit rock bottom, and that's why it kind of reminds me a little bit of the Orioles, where as bad as the Orioles were through all those years, they were never quite awful like the Astros got or the Pirates got sometimes. They never had a 100-loss season or anything like that, and that's kind of where the Rockies seem to me to be, like that kind of team. You know they're not going to be good, but you know they're not going to be one of the worst teams in baseball either. You know, they're kind of in that no man's land.
That's sort of the sad reality of being a Rockies fan, is every year when the Rockies haters come out of the woodwork on opening day, it's always, you know, there's 100,000 terrible Twitter accounts that try to parody the road to 100 losses. And of course, they all give up by like May or June because the Rockies play well out of the gate every year. They're not going to lose 100 games and it falls apart. That's always the thing you have to say when you're a Rockies fan, is, hey, you know, they've never actually lost 100 games in a season. When that's your bar for success,
yeah, exactly.
Like, you're really kind of scratching the bottom of the barrel. But those are all topics for another time, because we're here to discuss the podcast, which is Baseball by the Book, which you can find on iTunes and elsewhere. And this is kind of cool. We got to follow sort of the genesis of this. Justin left Sporting News, or parted ways with Sporting News, in early November. And I remember kind of watching you tweet over the next few weeks, like, I wanted something to do. I think maybe I'll start a podcast, something like that. And then this idea came up to do a podcast about baseball books. And it's one of those like no-brainer ideas that I'm sure a lot of people sat around thinking, like, man, why didn't I think of this? Like, this is such a great idea. Kind of tell us about how this came together for you.
Yeah, well, I think you described it fairly well. I was with Sporting News for 8 years, the last three of which I was the Major League Baseball editor. And just honestly, I was laid off in November along with several other people, including Jesse Spector, who I think a lot of your listeners are probably familiar with.
Another one of our favorites.
Yeah, he was our national baseball writer, and he and I got laid off the same day, 2 days after the election. And so I'm kind of at a point of figuring out what I want to do, you know, obviously looking for jobs and that sort of thing. But in the meantime, I kind of just, like you said, I kind of went on Twitter and was thinking out loud and thought to myself, you know, maybe I'll do a podcast. This is something I'd thought about before, but just had never had the time to do it. So I love baseball books. I have 100 of them on bookshelf probably. And I knew some authors through Twitter, Jeff Katz, who wrote a book about the 1981 baseball strike, and Dan Epstein, who's written several great books on the baseball in the 70s. So I knew these guys from Twitter, and I'd interacted with them and interviewed them for Sporting News and stuff. So I knew I had some guys who would do it for me. And so I started out with some of the people I knew. And they agreed to do it, and I was able to branch out. Just found people on the internet, you know, books that I've read, and I go to them. And now I have people coming to me, and it's been a lot of fun because, like you said, basically what I do is each episode I focus on one particular book. And even if that author I've talked to has written more than one book, we just talk about that book for 45 minutes, and it's been a lot of fun.
First episode, as you noted, was Split Season 1981, Jeff Katz talking about the 81 strike in large part. There are now 7 episodes out, and the most recent one, like we said, was about Brooks Robinson and Doug Wilson's book, the biography of Brooks Robinson. But there was one book that I really wanted to ask you about. I haven't got a chance to listen to this episode yet. It was the New Year's Eve edition, basically. But it was Lincoln Mitchell joined you to discuss his book, Will Big League Baseball Survive?
Yes.
We've been so often, we're in this conversation about how healthy baseball is right now. The revenues are outlandish, and player salaries are great. The owners are making a ton of money. TV money is all great. But there are a lot of challenges that baseball will face, as will every sport. You know, I think the NFL right now is really sort of walking blindly into an era of a lot of unknowns. Baseball seems to be kind of coming out of one of those, but there always seems to be one looming. Tell me about that conversation in that book.
Well, I would recommend, I didn't know anything about that book. He's a guy who came to me when I sort of put it out on Twitter. Hey, if you're a baseball author, let me know. And he came to me and he was able to get me a copy of the book. I had never heard of him. He's not a baseball writer by trade. He's more of a politics and economics writer. But it was a fascinating book. I was really just blown away by it because he looks at the future of baseball, of Major League Baseball, and from several different perspectives. And like you said, one of the things he talks about is TV money. And obviously baseball has a ton of money coming in through cable contracts, both nationally and at the local level. But he talks about how, you know, the future of TV, particularly cable TV, is in great doubt right now. We know that people just don't watch TV like they used to. So he talks about that a lot. He talks about the internationalization of the game and how there's, you know, and one of the things he talks about that was really fascinating to me is he said, right now, we just assume that all the best baseball players in the world are going to want to play in the United States.
That's
for a variety
of reasons.
That's
a great point.
But he says that's not necessarily going to be the case in 40, 50 years. And he's talking about a possibility of – he said there's a couple of possibilities. One is baseball expanding internationally and having teams in Asia and Central America and possibly even, you know, like Europe and China eventually. You know, he said obviously that would be a long-term thing. He said there's a possibility of baseball becoming smaller and becoming, you know, less of an international type of organization and more just an organization that makes money, but it's not the big international baseball behemoth that it is now. It's a really fascinating book, and if you care about the future of baseball, I highly recommend it.
That's a really good. That was episode number 6, and there are 7 out currently. And the thing that I really like about what you've been able to do so far is there are a lot of topics covered that I think people probably don't know about on such a large scale. It's not, you know, the standard conversation about, oh, this person wrote about Babe Ruth, or this is a story about the 94 strike or whatever. It's really unique and interesting topics. Are there certain authors that you gravitate toward? Are there certain topics that you want to discuss? I mean, there are a lot of baseball books. That doesn't mean that there are an overwhelming amount of good baseball books. I mean, there are a lot of books that are out there that tell certain stories and are about certain things, but they're not necessarily a thing that you'll put down and go, I feel like I'm a more knowledgeable baseball fan
for
knowing that. I mean, do you gravitate toward certain topics or certain styles with the podcast?
Well, to be honest with you, since I just started it, my first instinct was whoever's willing to come on the podcast with me. But now that I've established a little bit and it's gotten a little bit known out there, I think what I'm trying to do is vary it a lot. I mean, I want to make it so that each episode is a little different than the one before it. So, for instance, one of the things I did is after I got a few in the can, I just went to my bookshelf and I looked at books that I had read and enjoyed and tried to track down the authors. And one of the first ones I did with that was a book called Slide Kelly Slide, which is about Mike King Kelly, who was a superstar in the 19th century. And I thought, well, that'll be a fun one. I mean, I've done a lot of them on recent history. But this is like, you know, this is 19th century baseball. And it was a really interesting book. And it was written by a guy, Marty Appel, who's really well known in the baseball world. He was the PR director of the Yankees for a long time. And so I thought, well, that'd be an interesting one. So I found him on Twitter and he was willing to do it. And like I said, some of these ones are just guys that came to me. Lincoln Mitchell is a guy who came to me and I lucked out that was a really interesting book. Another guy named Jeremy Lehrman had written a book about MVP, MVP balloting over the years. And he came to me and I read that book and it was really interesting as well. I'm talking to Josh Wilker tonight about Cardboard Gods, which is a totally different than anything I've done already. You know, it's a very different kind of book than the ones I've done so far. So I say that's been, I'm looking for books that are good books and also just a variety of different things, biographies, histories, you know, statistical analysis, just whatever, what have you. Just I want to have a variety of things, if that makes sense.
There's a two-part question that I want to follow with because you kind of touched on it, but they're sort of in the same vein. Do you, first of all, personally have a favorite baseball book? I mean, one that you know, either has made the biggest impression on you or that you feel like you could still sit down and read again and love just as much, A. And B, do you have a few that you would consider like must-read baseball books for people who really, if you haven't read a lot of baseball stuff before, are there ones that stick out to you for people who want to get into it that you would recommend?
Yeah, absolutely. The book that has made the biggest impression on me as a baseball fan is the Bill James Historic Baseball Abstract. Both the first edition I got when it came out in the mid 80s, and then he had a more an updated version that came out in 2001. And they're different enough that they're both worth checking out. But when I read that book first time when I was in college, it just absolutely blew my mind. It was just a look at baseball history in just a totally different way than I had ever thought about it before. And again, the newer one probably is more relevant now just because it's more, you know, it's more recent. But yeah, either of those is just a great place to start if you're interested in baseball history, and especially if you like the sabermetric stuff. Another one's The Glory of Their Times, which is a classic written in the 60s, where the author Lawrence Ritter went back and interviewed players who had played in the early part of the 20th century. It's mainly guys from like pre-World War One era, and you know, the teens. And it's just it's really good. Just reminiscences of these guys at the time they played. It's one of the best oral histories I've ever read. Ball 4 is one I think everybody should read by Jim Bouton. That's definitely one that I think should be on everybody's list. But there's so many of them, really. But those three would maybe be a good place to start if you haven't read a lot of baseball history.
Justin, when you are getting something like this going, you know, being 7 episodes and a couple months in now, there's such a learning curve with kind of how you want to learn about a book and how an author wants to talk about a book. But this is something that has always interested me about people who do shows. You know, I always thought this about Jon Stewart when he hosted The Daily Show, because somebody told me once he reads every book of every author that he has on the show, which blows my mind because sometimes it takes me 6 months to finish a book.
Right, but exactly.
How much do you get to dive into the subject matter before you actually get to talk to these authors?
Well, yeah, I every book I've talked about, I've read.
That's amazing.
So what I did is I went to my shelf. So a lot of these books I had read in the past, you know what I mean? Like the one about the Slide Kelly Slide I had read before, the one about Brooks Robinson I read a couple of years ago. The 1981 Strike one, the Split Season 1981, Stars and Strikes by Dan Epstein. Those are books I had read in the past. So I just went back and sort of went through them and took notes, you know, to get ready for the interview. I didn't read them, you know, start to finish again, but I remembered enough about them that I was able to go through them. The other ones that have been ones that I have read, you know, I have read anew. And there's I've got one that I'm reading, and I got another one that I'm listening to on audio when I'm driving around. So I'm kind of like I think I'm gonna get sick of baseball books at some point here, but because I got a few more I'm committed to for interviews I got set for the next few months. But yeah, it's like I feel like I can't do the interview well if I haven't read the book.
That's a hell of a commitment, and that's what that impresses me so much, because yeah, like you said, I mean, you're not going to understand the intricacies of what you're discussing unless you've kind of been able to dive into it so far. But that is what makes a podcast so good, which again you can find on iTunes, Baseball by the Book. Justin, before we get you out of here, it's Hall of Fame voting time. You're a Baseball Writers Association of America member. Just kind of give us your thoughts on this year's Hall of Fame vote, because the discussion so much in recent weeks has been Bud Selig is in. Now we're seeing a surge in support for guys connected to PEDs, Roger Clemens, Barry Bonds, that type of stuff. In this era, and especially in this year with kind of maybe that watershed moment of Bud Selig being elected to the Hall of Fame, being selected for his inclusion, which comes with its own share of controversy, how do you view this year's class and what this vote means?
Well, yeah, first of all, I should just point out that I am not a voter.
Which I was going to ask and clarify, but yeah.
I've not been a member long enough, so I would need to be in for 5 or 6 more years before I'm eligible. And, of course, that'll sort of depend on my employment going forward, I guess. I am going to be able to keep my membership through 2017, so that'll be good. And if I get a job in baseball again, for, you know, the next year, I might be able to keep it beyond that. But anyway, that being aside, yeah, I don't have a vote, so I've never had to actually make that decision about, you know, Clemens and Bonds. I've done sort of fake ballots in the past, and I usually had them on it, just based on the idea that those two particular are, you know, so good that I don't think steroids was the reason they're Hall of Famers. You know what I mean? It didn't take them from borderline to Hall of Fame. It just, right. It just, you know, whatever it did to them, they would have been Hall of Famers regardless in my mind. And also, unlike say Manny Ramirez or Rafael Palmeiro, they never got, you know, they were never punished. They were never found. They never violated rule while the restrictions were in place, so that sort of thing. So I find it a little bit different. And I know a lot of people are making a big deal about Bud Selig, but I personally felt like when Tony La Russa got in a couple of years ago. That was kind of the moment for me when I said, well, I mean, Tony La Russa was a manager of, you know, those Jose Canseco era A's. He was a manager of, of Mark McGwire in 1998. And, you know, what he knew or didn't know, I don't know. But I know that he was asked about it in real time, both in Oakland and St. Louis. I know he denied it up and down. If he didn't know, he should have known. And so to me, it's like if we're putting him in easily, I don't see any reason that we're punishing the players. And so, but yeah, long story short, I think I would vote for at least those two. And then, you know, once they get in, then we'll start talking about the Sosas and the McGwires and that sort of thing.
Just so you're aware, appearing on this podcast is a you're now actually legally bound to vote for Larry Walker. So just so you know, when you do get the vote, if he's not in by that point, you have to check Larry Walker's box.
Well, that's a tough one because I was going through the ballot and, you know, obviously a lot of the guys who've had their ballots public so far have gone all 10. And some of those guys have Walker. Some of them have Guerrero, but not Walker. Some of them have Walker, but not Guerrero.
Yeah.
And it's a tough one
road.
For me.
Yeah. No, I hear you.
I think they're both deserving, but I'm not sure. I'd have to really dig in deeper to the numbers to see which is more deserving if they ended up being my, you know, 10th and 11th guys or something.
Okay.
It's a crowded ballot, man.
True. That is very true. That's what makes it so difficult. When I see guys post their ballots or I see their ballots posted, there's, of course, the Hall of Fame ballot tracker on Twitter as well. I think to myself how thankful I am that I do not have a vote because I don't know how on earth you narrow it down in a class like this.
It's I guess, and this year particularly just seems to be a tough one because I think you're seeing guys who haven't maybe gotten a ton of like Messina, for instance, is getting a lot more votes this year. And I think he's probably going to end up being around 50% this year, which he's been like in the 30s before. And, you know, Edgar Martinez, I think, is getting more. Pudge Rodriguez is actually getting more support than I anticipated him getting so far, at least. And obviously, you know, that'll change as all the ballots come in. But I thought because he was mentioned in the Canseco book, I thought he might be treated the same as some of these other guys, you know, with the PED associations. And it doesn't seem like he is, at least not by most of the writers. So that's interesting because he clearly belongs in my mind.
It is a very interesting class, and it's kind of an interesting indictment on what this will say about that generation or what it won't say or what it'll say about the writers who vote or don't vote in a certain way. But it's, you know, I'm kind of thankful I'm not part of it. Not that they're just handing out the Hall of Fame voting jobs to writers for MILB.com, but, you know, if they wanted to, I'd vote for Larry Walker. No, Justin McGwire is on Twitter. He is at JMcGwireMLB, and you can find the podcast on iTunes. It is Baseball by the Book. It's outstanding. Tune into that, subscribe, listen, give it a rating, give it a review, all that kind of stuff. And Justin, we've been looking forward to talking to you for so long, and I'm sorry that it took us until you know, this late in a cold winter, but I'm really glad that we got a chance to do it, and I'm sure we'll do it again soon.
Yeah, anytime, just let me know.
So once again, a big thanks to Justin McGwire for joining the show. You can find him on Twitter. He is at JMcGwireMLB. That's not the way Mark McGwire. It's MCGUIRE for Justin. I don't know why I stressed the I there. The U is the difference because McGwire was W-I-R-E.
Oh.
I don't know why I did that. It confused everybody.
I don't know, either, man. Sorry. You're so weird.
Sorry. Sorry, everyone. Sorry. Okay, let's do it. Woo! We need some Ask PDP, like, intro music.
Dun, 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 ask PDP. Dun, 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 ask your questions. Dun, 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 ask PDP.
I'm absolutely cutting that out and using it for every Ask PDP from now on. I really hope you know that you just did that to yourself. I really hope you know.
Awesome. It's going to live on in perpetuity. Love it.
Woo! Let's do it. Okay. Let's get things started. So we put out a call last night for Ask PDP questions. We got a lot of them in.
Yeah, thank you, guys. Mostly from Oliver Howard. Glad he's back on Twitter.
Yeah. And I want to start with one from Lance Lammers, who we just actually kind of discussed this topic a little bit in the first segment. But Lance's question is, quote, does Jeff Breidich love disguising his plans with vague comments, operating in total secrecy? I think, yeah.
I think absolutely.
I think he does. Jeff Breidich is very NFL-like in the way he... The personality that he puts on to the media. And I think the reasons for that are twofold. One, the way Jeff Breidich was reared as a member of the front office was under Dan O'Dowd. And the relationship between Dan O'Dowd and the Denver media was, to say the least, adversarial. So I don't think that Jeff Breidich is somebody who is anti-Denver media in any sense, but I do think that his restraint, his guarded persona, is very well practiced. And I think, from my perspective, I think serves him very well, too, because I think in order to stick the course, stay on the course of what he's trying to build in Colorado, he feels like the less information that he gives, the better, to a media base that, as we discuss regularly, is extremely not knowledgeable about what it takes to build a winning franchise in a baseball team. But I think beyond that, it's a competitive advantage when you are a new executive in baseball to keep people on their toes. So I don't think Jeff Breidich would be served in a positive sense in any way by just going out all the time and going on KOA and shitting all over Dexter Fowler or doing all the garbage that Dan O'Dowd did. I think Jeff Breidich is very smart in that regard. And the second part of this is, not only was it O'Dowd and Guyvette and that side, the baseball ops side, but we've discussed this at length too. The previous media relations staff with the Rockies had a very adversarial relationship with the media in town, which seems very counterintuitive and was very counterproductive for a long time. But Jay Alvis was the former, I think, VP of communications was his title. He didn't have a whole lot of friends in the Denver media, and the Denver media did not act very friendly toward him. So I think that atmosphere has always existed in the front office as well. But I don't dislike that about Jeff Breidich. And I think, you know, you and I are biased because we've had a little bit of contact with him prior to when he was the GM. He's a very friendly guy. But he even said, somebody asked him a question in one of the press conferences, like, man, are you like this all the time? And he was like, no, I mean, if you ask my wife, like, this is an act that I put on. This, yeah. What I do here is an act. He's a professional sports general manager. He doesn't need to be all buddy-buddy with everybody. I don't care about that. Just make them win.
Yeah, and do the things that will make the team better. That's all we ask.
We don't ask that
you have to be a nice guy.
Exactly.
Or have to give us a good quote. That was Clint Hurdle's job. Clint Hurdle gave great quotes. He was a terrible manager with the Rockies. He figured it out when he went to Pittsburgh. Good for him. Still gives great quotes. Also is a good manager now. So he's a solid twofer. But he was not like that in Denver.
Right.
You don't need the guy to give you a great quote. You want that, you get Rex Ryan. You want a good football coach, you get Bill Belichick. You know?
Damn, man. That hit the nail on the head. Holy cow. But yeah, I really don't have a problem with it. I know a lot of people get frustrated by that, but I really don't have a problem with it.
And I get it with people who it's their job to get quotes from Jeff Breidich, you know, and I understand they want something better than the vanilla crap that they get, but you know, it's his prerogative to keep it close to the vest as well.
Okay. Let's move on. Ashton Yarbrough submits two questions. One, who do you think the Rockies will beat in the World Series? And then two, on to a serious question. What is the one thing, if there is one thing, that you don't like about Rockies fans?
Well, the first one, they're going to get the rematch that we were supposed to get in 2007. They will beat the Cleveland Indians in the World Series this year.
Okay.
The one thing, talk about Rockies fans. I mean, we've kind of already discussed it a little bit here today. Yeah. It's the constant moaning about every single thing. That's the constant moping and how everyone's just so morose, like almost immediately about every possible thing that goes on with the Colorado Rockies.
No matter what, it's always a disaster.
Even good things, even great things that happen with the Rockies, people are always like, oh, well, it's not going to last, or oh, yeah, Coors, whatever. Like, that's what I hate the most about Rockies fans. They're always such downers.
Rockies fans are basically me in relationships. Pretty much, like, well, she likes me now, but this is just going to be a disaster eventually. Like, we're just all Eeyore. Just one gigantic fan base of Eeyores. I agree.
That's kind of my biggest thing with the Rockies. I really do not like that about Rockies fans at all.
And again, like we were talking about earlier, some of it is warranted. When you have been a mostly losing franchise for 23 years, you're going to imbibe a lot of negativity. Somebody on Purple Row a few years ago did a column about how long it would take for the Rockies to get back to 500 as a franchise, and it was like 15 straight years of winning 100 games or something absurd like that. So when you have been a largely losing franchise for a long time, there's going to be a lot of negativity just by nature that you're going to have to deal with. But at the same time, yeah, I mean, like, kind of the point I think you were getting at is, like, it's sports. You know, like, we're trying to have fun. When opening day comes around in April, when spring training comes around in March, like, I'm sure I'll go on one of my lovey-dovey Twitter rants where I'm just like, hey, man, we're all on the same side of
this. This is so great.
We all want them to be successful. Yeah. Like, it's baseball season. The sun is out. Things are fine until, you know, Anthony and I are thrown into a work camp for political dissidents by the end of the year, I'm sure. But, like, things are okay when it's baseball season. It's all good. We all want them to win. We all want them to be successful. But then when we all start sniping at each other, like that annoying family that's been in a cabin for the holidays for too long, that does get draining. That gets really annoying, where it's just like any little thing happens and it's just automatically. I know there is already a segment of the fan base that no matter what, the first move that Bud Black makes that conceivably costs the Rockies a game, there will be people already out there. Well, they went from a high school manager to a retread from the Padres. What do you expect? Like, I know that segment already exists.
You know, that's a scheduled tweet probably for a lot of people that actually follow us coming on April 3rd at, you know, 10:45 p.m.
Oh, you put Jake McGee in a one-run game. What do you think is going to happen? Hashtag Bad Black. You people can have that for free. You can have that one for free.
I get it.
Okay, fire away.
From AZ Axel, how much development is left to be had from the Rockies rotation, enough to compete with LA and San Francisco? They are not going to compete in that regard yet. I do not believe it because they're still very, very young. You know, John Gray's finishing off his first full season. Tyler Anderson as well. Jeff Hoffman has not put in a full season yet, really. So I think we have a little bit of time to get these guys ready to go. But I believe we are kind of where the, you know, Giants and Dodgers were maybe 6-7 years ago, you know, when they had a lot of those big guys come with the Bumgarners and the Kershaws. Because right now the Rockies rotation is, what, Gray, Hoffman, Anderson, Bettis,
Chatwood,
and
a mix of others who could conceivably fill into those spots.
Right. So, out of all those guys, three of them have what, 2 years or less of service time.
Yeah.
You know, so there's going to be growing pains. You know, obviously that's going to happen. We know that. But I don't think they're quite ready to be at that point yet, because it's also hard to imagine a team ready to be that competitive as the Dodgers and Giants are right now, because those teams are, you know, the top of the line in terms of rotations, in terms of, you know, winning teams, and they have been for, you know, the better part of this decade. So it's hard for the Rockies to say that they are that close, but they're closer than they've been in quite some time.
Yeah, I think the situation with the Rockies needs to be, you have to be able to hang in pitching-wise, but you have to be able to outslug those teams. The Rockies are going to be, I think, strongly improved pitching staff-wise, rotation-wise, and bullpen-wise, especially we talked about kind of that regression to the mean from just how bad guys were last year. And in theory, they can't all be that bad at the same time again, or at least you hope. But actually, there's a really good story up on MLB.com right now. Mark Goodpal, Mike Petriello, who discusses John Gray as one of the 2017 breakout pitchers to watch. And that's not like Rockies breakout pitcher to watch or National League West breakout pitcher to watch. That's all of baseball. He sees John Gray as that guy, as being a frontline kind of guy. And if you have that coupled with good Chettis, coupled with a good version of Tyler Chatwood, if he can somehow figure out a way to, you know.
Why don't you just say Tyler Chatgood?
Oh, that would have been good. That would have been good.
It would have been Chatgood.
It would have been Chatgood. Oh. Not your best. But, you know, if he can mitigate some of those struggles that he had at Coors Field, you know, and then behind him, Tyler Anderson was a stud last year. Jeff Hoffman, theoretically, could be like John Gray in a different version, you know, a slightly different looking John Gray. Germán Márquez, a fantastic prospect that they acquired. Even Kyle Freeland, the way he finished last year, people have really forgotten about Kyle Freeland, but don't sleep on him. He was great at the end of last year for Albuquerque. So I think there is a good deal in terms of the strides to be made in developing those guys. And I agree with Anthony. They're not going to be the Giants. They're not going to be the Dodgers. But if you can be like the 2007 and 2009 Rockies and pitch effectively, your offense is going to be good no matter what. That will carry you into contention with those teams.
I agree. So here's one from Mike Flick at Flickerbach.
Okay.
We keep talking about the improving rotation. Which young pitcher might take a step back in 2017? Now, I've got an idea on this one. I think it could. I'm hoping not, of course. This is all we hope not. We hope they don't take steps back. But Tyler Anderson, considering the injury history that Tyler Anderson has had in his career, last year he was very, very healthy and very, very productive when he was on the pitching mound last year. A 3.54 ERA, a 3.59 FIP as well. So almost exactly the same number for ERA and FIP, which is very tough to do in for a guy like who's pitching in Coors Field for the most part. So, you know, if you give him a full season, he made just 19 starts last year, a real full season. Who knows? Because the injury history with all the elbow injuries, the shoulder, the bone spurs, you know, it gives you a lot of pause because he was relatively injury free last year. So if one guy in that rotation would take a step back, I believe, hoping not, that it could be Tyler Anderson.
I would agree. I think for a lot of the same reasons that you said, the most worrisome part is the injury part, because the injury that he had, the stress fracture in the elbow, was so weird. You kind of don't really know how long-term that's going to be. It seems like the type of thing, you know, Tyler Anderson had an elbow issue, came back in 2014, was the best pitcher in minor league baseball, won the minor league ERA title, and then all of a sudden 2015, the injury's back. So you don't really know just how finicky something like that can be. We certainly hope that that's not the case in any way, but that worries me a little bit. But I think, you know, kind of like what you were saying, he was just so good that it would make sense that he might be a guy who takes a step back this year. But all of that in consideration, I think even if Tyler Anderson does take a step back, so many of these other guys are poised to take big steps forward that it negates maybe that loss in effectiveness. Or you hope, anyway.
Right.
From Nick Stellini at Stellini Tweets, who is one of our best pals on Twitter and on the podcast, and writing about baseball at FanGraphs. Quote, do the black vests provide some sort of Dungeons & Dragons-style agility buff or what?
I think they contain a superpower inside the vests that make them play better.
Okay.
It's like, I don't know, it's like some kind of magical...
It could work.
Potion. I don't know.
Okay. That could work. By the way, Thomas Harding has been doing a lot of discussion about uniforms and stuff with the Rockies on Twitter over the last few days, which has been great. And somebody did note, this is something that we've talked about on BDP before. Somebody noted that the most grating thing about the black vests is that the Rockies don't cut out the inside fabric in the letters on the names on the back of the jerseys, and that drives me insane. And somebody else tweeted that to Thomas, and I was very, very happy about it. Very happy about it. Okay, our good buddy Oliver Howard has returned to Twitter after a long hiatus.
Which I envy him.
Yeah. Oliver, I know. God, me too. I took a week off, and like I smelled the air around me. Food tasted better. I wanted to like be in contact with real human beings. It was one of the best things I've ever done. And so maybe one of these days I'll finally just break myself. I've been off Facebook for years.
Yeah, you have.
And yeah, I don't know what it is.
You're not missing anything. Yeah.
I don't know what it is about Twitter that's kept me hooked. But one of these
breaking news is what keeps me have to be hooked on.
No,
Twitter,
that's
sucks.
The problem. Exactly. Yeah. Like when you work in an industry like we do, like you sort of have to be. I learn almost all the news that I get, I find in some way from Twitter and then read elsewhere. You know what I mean? But so I'm very envious of Oliver. But Oliver tweets in to the show.
He had a lot of tweets.
A lot of Ask BDP questions. We're going to take two things right off the bat, and then we'll address a baseball one. Number one, did you miss me? I've been Twitter-free for months. Number two, can you explain everything you've tweeted in the last few months since I haven't been here?
Coors... Oh, God, Trump, Coors, Ian Desmond, really?
A lot more oh, God, Trump.
Shoulder shrug emoji.
Yep, my favorite.
And that's pretty much it.
I went after Penn State football pretty hard yesterday.
Yeah, that's no surprise.
We've gone after CU a lot. You know. It's been about the same, Oliver. You really haven't missed much.
Yeah.
really haven't missed a whole lot.
Oliver.
It's never been entertaining.
Yeah, we have a wheelhouse, Oliver, and we try to stay inside it.
Oliver is, by the way, one of our very earliest followers. Oliver followed the show. He's like our 10th follower or something.
I think almost anybody. Yeah,
pretty much. It was like him and Cam. They were like the earliest.
Yeah, somehow Cam was in there too.
Cam when he was like 12, by the way. Cam is still only 12. So a couple of follow-up questions from Oliver. One, when's Tyler getting married? Oliver, that is one thing that you missed. When I meet Cecily Strong from Saturday Night Live, presumably like a few hours later, we'll be getting married. But this is a real baseball one. Who's going to be second in the division behind the Rockies?
Ooh. Well, since the even year magic is done, the Giants still have a shot, I guess. But, you know, it's not going to be the Padres.
Yeah,
so
we know that
sure.
much.
Know that. D-backs, nah. Flip a coin. I'm just going to say the Doyer.
Okay, I'm going to go with them too.
Yeah,
they're good and they're going to continue to be good. They got Justin Turner back.
They got
Kenley Jansen back.
They have the exact same team they've had every single year for the last like 7 years. They're going to make the playoffs.
The
and
Dodgers
they're not
are going to be
in the World Series.
Exactly. The Dodgers will be a great division round two championship series finisher. Like that's pretty much where it'll end up. Divisional series, championship series. That'll be it. Oddly enough, I kind of wish the Dodgers would win the National League just because I think that a cornerstone baseball franchise like that deserves to be in the World Series. The Cubs were in it. The Mets were in it. The Giants have been in it all the time. I think the Dodgers deserve that due. Maybe Dodgers fans don't.
I mean, Craig Goldstein's nice.
Eric Stevens nice. Yeah.
Mike Petriello's nice.
Yeah, that's true. There are a lot of good ones on Twitter. That is true. Yeah. Damn, that's true.
Yeah, well,
which is why I need to just come to L.A. and go to a game with you then this year, and I can see them in their natural habitat.
Well, you can come to a Jethawks game because they are the
new affiliate,
and the Jethawks are the closest minor league team to me now.
And we could go see them play the Rancho Cucamonga Quakes, the Class A advanced affiliate of the Los Angeles Dodgers.
Go hang out with Jason Schwartz, the voice of the Lancaster Jethawks.
Yeah, who we're going to have on the show at some point very soon.
Yeah, I saw him the other week. He's the radio voice for Long Beach State women's basketball.
Oh, okay. Didn't he do USC women's basketball for a while?
He might have, I think.
Huh. There's a lot of very random. Keaton Gologli was the Modesto Nuts radio guy who I guess we should bid a fond farewell to Keaton. We won't get a chance to talk to him anymore since they're a Seattle Mariners affiliate now. But Keaton does like Michigan State women's basketball. There's a lot of very random broadcast connections for the Cal League guys.
Oh, yeah.
Anyway. All right. Well, that's going to do it for Ask PDP. And that's going to do it for episode number 92 of the Purple Dinosaur Podcast. Buy our shirts, purpledinosaurpodcast.bigcartel.com. Tweet into the show.
We'll get new stuff coming up, I promise.
We will. 2017, we'll have some new stuff. I should get to work on some of those.
Yeah.
Should probably do some of that stuff. PurpleDinosaurPodcast@gmail.com is the email address. Anthony is on Twitter @MasterTones. I am @TylerMon. I'm going to try to be a little bit nicer on Twitter this year.
Okay.
That'll last until we're recording on January 3rd. I'll be surprised if that lasts until January 5th. But we'll see. All right. I guess that's it. That's it. And that's all. We love you. We love you so much. All of you for tuning in. Thanks. And next week, we'll be back with a minute by minute dissection of the movie Creed on our new platform, our new programming line of work.
We need to do another another drunken episode
let's do that because there is a Rockies video, like a retrospective video of the 93 season that's on YouTube that I think Will has tweeted into us, either Will or Kyle Bishop.
I think it was Will. Yeah,
it was either Will or Kyle. One of them has tweeted into us that video several times. We haven't gotten a chance to watch it, so we either need to do that or we need to find just like an old Rockies game. Or another thing that you and I have discussed is playing each other on MLB The Show and broadcasting that as if it was a game. Because Anthony and I called many a baseball game together in our lives, so we need to possibly do that as well. It's going to be all kinds of fun.
Love it.
All right, boys and girls, we'll talk to you. I don't want to say next week as of yet, but we'll talk to you in the next couple of weeks. And until then, we love you. Thanks for tuning in. It's good to be back. Bye.